Welcome to Grid Talk, a series of conversations with the leaders and innovators shaping the 21st century grid. Hosting the podcast is Marty Rosenberg, an award-winning energy journalist. The series is sponsored by the Department of Energy's Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Now, here's Marty Rosenberg with Grid Talk.
Hi, welcome to Grid Talk. Today we have with us Sam Byrne, who's Vice President of Operations of Equinor, a Norwegian firm headquartered their renewables operations in Stamford, Connecticut, where Sam sits. Good morning, Sam. How are you?
Hi, Marty. Good to talk to you.
Let's get our feet wet, as they say. Offshore wind has gotten very big globally in some parts of the world. You and I have chatted about the fact that China seems to have 105 of them, the UK 39, Germany 28, Vietnam 26, Denmark 13, and the United States, you can count them on one hand. Talk about the global situation and why it's been so slow to take off in the United States.
Yeah, sure, Marty. If we just look at wind, both onshore and offshore first, I think there's about 1,000 gigawatts globally now, and about 10% of that is probably offshore. But that's grown over the last couple of years, and the growth rate for offshore is faster than onshore, but from a smaller base. It was probably around 850 gigawatts onshore and maybe 65 gigawatts offshore only a year and a half or so ago. But there's a number of reasons for one technology or one country to take off faster or more slowly than a different place. And it's hard to pinpoint one. So those might be support structures, which could be in terms of power prices or tax incentives. It could have to do with the existing generation infrastructure and when that might retire, what condition it's in. Is there good and sufficient power supply that's going to last 20 years, or is there a lot of electricity growth and it needs to be replaced next year and something needs to replace it? It could have to do with the transmission lines and where it's convenient to put in new electricity and what type of electricity. It has to do with some of the construction costs and the logistics. So is the ground good? Is it amenable to the construction of a wind farm onshore or offshore, the subsea ground? And then, of course, the wind speed. So is there good offshore wind resource, or is the wind slower and there's better onshore wind resource and good construction, and there's fossil fuel plants that are retiring very, very quickly? So that has to do with some of the reasons globally. In the U.S., as you've mentioned, there's basically an imperceptible amount of offshore wind at the moment. I think 2016 was when the Block Island wind farm, a 30-megawatt wind farm, came into operations off of Rhode Island. And that's despite the country being a fairly successful wind player. There's about 150 gigawatts here in the U.S. onshore. So we're starting to see the acceleration now. Some of it has to do with support. Some of it has to do with the technology that's come in into being. Some of it has to do with just the need for electricity and the fact that wind is getting more and more competitive on a levelized cost of electricity. If it's not the cheapest, sometimes it's close to the cheapest.
So let me just interject for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll refer to what I call the Teddy Kennedy factor. When the first proposals for offshore wind were announced, he said that he did not want to be sailing his boat off of Hyannis Port and looking at wind turbines. Is that still a lingering issue, the aesthetics of these turbines? And then a part B to my question is, what's been happening lately? Around COVID and then a year ago, we saw the cost of offshore wind went up. How are we getting past that now? And do you see a clear path forward?
Yeah, about to say those are two different questions. But the aesthetics of wind is obviously a personal a sort of impression that people have of the turbines. And it's both an onshore and an offshore issue, it can be. Offshore, some of the wind farms are obviously much closer to land and can be seen quite easily, and some are farther away, and as we move around the curvature of the Earth, you know, they start to disappear around the horizon. But I think that the Teddy Kennedy issue, as you put it, is definitely still a lingering issue, and it's a personal one, and it's not a scientific issue, right? There's not a scientific explanation for why something might be good or bad for that. So it is an issue, and it'll continue to be one, I would expect so.
Let's talk about the technology.
Yeah.
Why would it make sense for a country like China, which must have enormous energy demand, mm-hmm. go so heavily into offshore wind, while the United States, where there's a desire to get cleaner, resilient, renewable energy, and avoid the need for major on-land construction of transmission lines, totally bypass or largely bypass the potential of offshore wind? It's been slower to take off here.
I can give some reasons. I'm by far an expert on I'm not an expert on China, but I mean, piece of it has to do just with industrial policy. And so I think there's a lot of electricity generation being built in China, not just offshore wind, but all kinds of generation onshore as well. It's a huge country for construction of wind farms. There's a number of Chinese turbine manufacturers that operate mainly in China, at least at this point. And their main markets are in China. And some of that has to do with sort of government support for the construction and then for the turbine, the local turbine manufacturers. So I think that there are a number of reasons of why China is sort of a special market and has a lot of reasons. But I wouldn't want to sort of speculate on all of them as I'm not a China expert at all.
Okay, so let's get back to the current moment. Tell us a bit about Equinor. My notes say you have about 16, you plan to have about 12 to 16 gigawatts installed by 2030. Talk about that ambition, how important it is, how you hope to achieve it, mm-hmm. and how it relates to where we've been a year ago when there was a flurry of articles about supply chain issues and other factors driving up the cost of wind.
Yeah. So maybe just quickly on the first question, and I'm sure we'll come back to it to speak a little bit more specifically on the U.S., but Equinor is a global energy player, and it plays across the energy sector, both in traditional oil and gas, but it's committed to a transition, and it's building offshore wind farms globally. We have wind farms in the U.K., in Europe, in Norway in particular. We have operations here, and then we also have some onshore operations as well on a global scale. But when we look back at 2023, which I think you asked about before, and now just again, it was a tumultuous year in the offshore wind industry in the U.S. and globally. It takes just a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of collaboration to build an offshore wind farm. And there were financial and logistical problems last year that hit all at the same time. Supply chain crunches, inflation rate. We saw sort of all of these things taking off at once and hitting a number of players in the sector. So the consequence of that was widespread problems here and abroad. Challenged offtake agreements, unsubscribed tenders, project delays, challenged financials. These were major themes that hit different people and along the value chain in different ways for developers.
So, yeah. If I could focus that, yeah. Let's talk about your plans in New York State. Mm-hmm. You're planning to build up to 130 wind turbines, 15 to 30 miles off Long Island, 2.1 gigawatts. And that hit a snag and now it's going forward. Get us up to date briefly on that.
Yeah, so a consequence of us from 2023 was really focusing on accelerating Empire Wind and Empire Wind 1 in particular. So that was, or Empire Wind is a New York project, 15 to 30 miles south of Long Island. It will make landfall in South Brooklyn, around the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, which is another piece of the project to revitalize that terminal as a construction and operations hub. It'll use a 15 megawatt turbine, which is a big machine. You know, it's about 145 meters tall or so.
Compare that to the Empire State Building or an airplane.
Roughly say Washington Monument. I guess think about that.
Okay. So you're going to be putting up 130 Washington Monuments offshore that'll be rotating.
Exactly. And that rotation creates a swept area that's roughly say 8 or 9 football fields if you were to sew them together. So it really is a mega project off the coast of New York. Each of those rotations that'll create an area of 8 eight or so football fields, powers a home for about 1.5 days. It'll power about 1 million homes once completed in totality. So it's a really substantial project.
And you recently concluded an agreement with New York State for the price of this power being higher than New York State originally envisioned, but commensurate with the business pressures you face to make this project a reality.
Yeah, so one of the things that New York did last year was announce a rapid auction process for their offshore wind industry. And they wanted to get shovel-ready, accelerated projects in that were financially viable. So it was a competitive process that Equinor took part in and fortunately won. And we'll be building Empire Wind 1 soon as a consequence of that.
So the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, it's a piece of land that faces almost directly across from the Statue of Liberty, right? Across from Manhattan?
It's just, you can see the Statue of Liberty from the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal. It's just off there.
And this is an industrial area that is in need of development. You're going to be constructing components made elsewhere in the world. They are into turbines, loading them on barges, taking them under the Verrazano Bridge and out to sea. I'll mention this just because it's been in the news lately with concern about Baltimore. Folks that haven't been in Brooklyn don't know there are no pillars in the middle of the straits under the Verrazano. Do you think it should be easy transporting these out? And at the same time, it will be a spectacle seeing these things, will it not?
Yeah, well, building a wind farm is always complex. There's always challenges, and it's always a massive engineering undertaking. So just in terms of the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, it's about 73 acres, and it'll be comprised of the substation, the operations facility, and the staging area. And the staging area is where these components will come from places in the U.S. as well as abroad, and they will... And then they'll be taken on barges and shipped out to be assembled at the wind farm itself, at the project site. And of course, a lot of engineering has gone into both how we get things in and how we get them out to sea. So the bridge is definitely a piece of that consideration. We're confident that that'll be done smoothly. And then a lot of assembly will be happening out at the Empire Wind Farm site rather than on land to make that possible.
The components you will be assembling, will they become coming primarily from Vestas in Denmark? Where will they be made, and how many countries will be involved in sending you the components?
It's a number of countries. I don't want to give you the wrong answer, but it's quite a few. And some of it will be American companies who manufacture. We've got Vestas is the turbine manufacturer, and some of their manufacturing, of course, is done in Europe. And then we've got some domestically too. For example, the vessel we're using, the service operations vessel, the SOV, is manufactured down in Louisiana with Edison Schwest at their shipyard there. So it's a bit of a mix, but yeah, it all comes together at the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal.
So my understanding is it'll be 1,000 jobs building that terminal.
Yeah.
Has it started, and when will it be completed? And when do you start getting the first turbine out off of Brooklyn and Long Island?
Currently, it's prep, so it's pre-construction work. Pile driving has happened, some remediation work, but groundbreaking will happen imminently, sometime this spring, at South Brooklyn Marine Terminal.
Just talk about the construction work, the difficulty of recruiting workers, and then talk about the permanent workforce you envision there supporting this infrastructure.
Yeah, so there's a number of different types of job that we see from a wind farm in construction. So we start out with the construction sector, basically. And there we've got your foremen, your construction managers, your project managers, your engineers, your HSE advisors. So there's a lot of construction work that goes into it.
What is HSE?
Oh, health, safety, and environment.
Okay.
So it's sort of it's full spectrum type of jobs. Carpenters, electricians, scaffolders, welding. I mean, it's sort of everything goes into building. We'll be building a building, we'll be building a substation, and we'll be building a port, essentially. And then those skills are also necessary for the construction of the wind farm offshore. And then when we go into the permanent operations, which will last for, say, 35 years, again, we need maintenance technicians, marine and vessel crews to get out there, planning teams, medics, more HSE, more engineers. We'll have the warehouse and logistics at South Brooklyn Marine Terminal. We'll have a control room, which requires control room operators to monitor, to interact with the grid, to know when we need to curtail. There'll be the facility maintenance. And then there's the offsite roles like finance and control, power trading, IT systems. So there's a lot of roles that come along with a wind farm. And then there's hopefully, you know, the local coffee shops, restaurants, and businesses that grow up around the South and Brooklyn Marine Terminals to support it.
So when you estimate 1,000 construction jobs, is that building the marine terminal itself? Does it include erecting the wind turbines?
That's across the construction phase. So for the terminal as well as the wind farm.
Now, do you have workers in Brooklyn that know how to maintain wind turbines, and how do you go about finding them and training them?
Yeah, so the wind turbine technician business or sector is one of the, I'm a little biased, I guess, one of the most interesting sectors in the U.S. It's the fastest or one of the fastest growing jobs in the U.S., according to the Bureau of Labor. Most of that happens onshore in the Midwest and Texas and California, sort of in that wind belt, especially down the central part of the U.S. But we'll need them in Brooklyn. We'll need a workforce that goes out on the vessel. It'll mostly be rotational work 2 weeks out, 2 weeks back type of lifestyle. And we'll be building up that workforce over the next couple of years and then through the lifetime of the wind farms and hopefully growing it as the industry grows in the U.S.
Is this going to be a major, I used the word spectacle earlier, is this going to be a major impact on the city of New York, its culture, its engagement in renewables? Is it going to be highly visible, and what kind of response are you getting from folks like the mayor and Senator Schumer? Do they think this is a major prize that's going to take New York City into the next century?
I think there's a big view that this is going to be, I wouldn't say a spectacle, but a very good thing for New York, both for the community as well as for clean electricity. And we've seen that through good support and engagement with local stakeholders, whether they be in the government or they be in community level. And that's what we're trying to be focused on. And while the wind farm will be 15 to 30 miles out, we'll have a lot of people sitting in South Brooklyn who are going to need to be good neighbors and good community members there. We're building a learning center where we hope to engage with the community and schools and work with them. We have an investment fund to work with local businesses, especially those related to the offshore wind business. And we'll even be doing some tours of the facility through the construction in the first couple of years to try to sort of engage with the community. But it is something I think that could, that is engaging. We are engaging and getting very good sort of collaboration from many stakeholders in the government or elsewhere. And one of the key ones of those is the New York Economic Development Corporation, AEDC, which is a obviously a key relationship for us.
So Empire Wind is going to be 2.1 gigawatts. New York State has declared that it wants 9 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030. That's just 6 years off. Do you see a lot of new players joining you offshore New York State? And is there any signs that they're going to reach that goal? And how important will 9 gigawatts of offshore wind be to New York State?
Well, I think there's a number of players in the industry. I mean, we've seen Eversource and Ørsted. We've seen Avangrid. There's Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners. There's a lot of developers who are, I think, working towards the Mid-Atlantic, New York, New England area and developing wind farms off of that area. And so I think that there is good engagement with the state of New York and other places to try to make these goals a reality. There's obviously ambitious targets set both at state levels, and not just New York, but many state levels have ambitious targets that I think we in the developer side and the investor side and supplier side and the government all need to work towards, you know, hitting together. But ultimately, it's to create a sustainable, reliable power grid, which is, I think, critical for the country.
Is this ambition of New York State's going to have a major impact on its grid? And given, talk a little bit about the physics. Offshore wind, I understand, is probably more reliable than onshore wind in terms of predictability and time frame. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the resource itself, the wind resource, is it blows more strongly and more consistently offshore, and it better matches electric consumption patterns than a lot of other renewable sources, so in the afternoon and in the evening. So from a just sort of electric fundamentals physics side of it, it's quite good. But of course, it's offshore, and we need to get it onshore and connect it, so it requires the subsea cables to reach the land and make landfall, and then it needs to plug into the grid. And all of that's a major project that will need transmission developers, will need the government, and will need the generation developers all to collaborate on. So I think that there will be changes to the grid. I can't say which one specifically, but for sure, the wind farm is only worth anything if it plugs into the electric grid somewhere.
So are you not developing the cable infrastructure to take it from the turbine to the marine terminal, or are you?
We take it from the turbine and we take it to the substation at South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, where that's the point of interconnect to the grid. So we are developing that piece of it.
You've talked about the East Coast. Let's segue to a discussion of technology in the West Coast. You're also involved with Atlas Wind that's developing offshore wind that's not as firmly fixed to the seabed. Talk about that technology, floating technology, and the promise of that.
Yeah, so as we get into deeper depth of water, and there's often, you know, of course, there's often good deep water sites with good wind resource, we move towards floating wind. And here, Equinor is one of the few companies that has floating wind experience. We've got a floating wind farm in the UK, and we've got a floating wind farm in Norway already, Hywind Tampen there. But this is sort of a next generation of technology that will allow us to tap into good wind resources in convenient locations near coastal urban hubs, but with sea depths that are more challenging, or at least more technically challenging than the fixed foundations that we have today. So it does represent a next phase, I think, of the technology, one where some people have dipped their toes in, like Equinor, and the West Coast is potentially a big region for that, as are some places in South Korea, for example.
Is it comparable cost to more fixed offshore turbines, or is it more expensive?
It depends a little bit, and sorry to give kind of a legal, not legal as in depends, or a political answer. It depends, but it'll depend a lot on where that is, and what type of foundation we would have been using, and what the seabed would have been like, and how far away that fixed foundation would have been. So the cost of as we were discussing before, getting the energy back to shore. So it's definitely a different type of technical challenge. But of course, it needs to develop to the point where it's also a feasible electricity source for the ratepayer at the end of the day.
How fast is the turbine technology itself changing? You talk about these units off of Long Island being 15 megawatts. I remember not too long ago, folks were bragging about offshore wind units off of Germany that were 5 megawatts. They thought there would never be anything bigger. Are we peaked out, or could we go past 15 megawatts? And what would a much more powerful turbine look like?
Yeah, if you drive through the Palm Springs area, you can get kind of a history lesson of wind turbines. You can see the old lattice tower, sort of small kilowatt machines, to much bigger ones. And then soon we'll be getting 15 megawatts into the water off of New York. But I think right now equipment manufacturers, the turbine manufacturers, have been pretty vocal that the pace of development for wind turbines is unsustainable in terms of CapEx, in terms of quality, in terms of making small improvements. So we are seeing kind of a pause or at least a slowdown in the pace of development. That being said, I'm sure...
When you say pace of development, you mean making units with larger and larger outputs.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, bigger. I guess bigger is what I meant, okay. Actually. So hopefully we can see more output from the same size and also then scaling that up. But I'm sure that we will continue to see bigger bigger turbines with greater output in the future. That comes with a lot of challenges, right? The whole industry actually needs to keep pace with it. Sometimes we think just bigger is better, but it needs to be transported somehow. And when you start thinking about how large the technology is and can be, the transportation, the foundation, these things all need to grow at the same time as the turbine. So it's not just the equipment manufacturing technology, but it's the whole industry along with it.
My last question, Sam, is to ask you to personally reflect on this industry and your involvement in it. You've been with Equinor for a scant 6 months, but before that, you were with Vestas, the Danish company, for 8 years, first in Denmark, then in the Asia-Pacific region. Vestas, of course, is one of the largest developers, manufacturers of turbines in the world. What's your sense of this industry now? Is it still the cowboy pioneer era? Is it a much more mature industry, or you see it segueing into a more mature industry? What do the rest of us that don't pay attention need to know about wind power and what's coming?
I think it's much, much more mature. If we look just at the levelized cost of electricity, wind is often the best source of new generation that we could build. So just from a sort of maturity of the technology, financial sense, it can be it's often the most attractive generation that we can add to the grid. It's also getting to the point where sort of we're seeing more professional companies moving in. It's not just sort of, as you said, cowboy industry. I think the regulators are involved. I think trade groups are speaking as one voice. So I think it's becoming more and more of a mature, established industry than it was before, for sure.
So just on the macro scale, solar as it relates to wind, is one growing faster? Are they growing in tandem? What could we expect on the renewable front?
I think the connection was a little blurry for me there for a second, Marty, but I think you were asking about solar versus wind, and it depends a little bit, I think, on where you are. I think they're both growing very, very quickly. And certainly some resource conditions are better for solar than for wind. So those solar will be a more attractive source than wind, but both, I think, are good generation sources within the power industry.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Marty.
We've been talking with Sam Byrne, Vice President of Operations of Equinor in Stamford, Connecticut. Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, a production of the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Electricity. We regularly convene conversations with thought leaders in the fast-changing electric sector in America and around the world. Please send us feedback or questions at gridtalk@nrel.gov. And we encourage you to give the podcast a rating or a review on your favorite podcast platform. For more information about the series now in its fourth year, or to subscribe, please visit smartgrid.gov.
Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, presented by the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Subscribe through your favorite podcast provider or visit smartgrid.gov for more information.